This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
And the truth is, we're all walking towards the cliff of nuclear annihilation like lemmings.
Welcome, I'm Alex Smith. You know, beyond abrupt climate change, there is another way humans can wipe ourselves out with technology. A thermonuclear war can do it. And those 16,000 nuclear warheads are still on alert, even more so after the revival of the Cold War and the Civil War in the Ukraine. You may not want to hear about it, it's scary stuff, but this threat is ugly and real, it's not going away. The world's greatest anti-nuclear activist joins us in just a minute. Later in the show, we'll hear from an expert in the commons, the wealth we all share, outside the grip of capitalism, the markets, and almighty money. David Bollier joins us. First this. Helen Caldicott, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
You know, it's a real honor to have you join us today. We could talk for hours about unsafe nuclear reactors and the plot to sell more of them to developing countries. We could talk at great length about the reactor meltdowns at Fukushima. That's still ongoing. But I have called you today, Helen, about a story nobody wants to hear about, even though it could threaten us with extinction as much as climate change, maybe sooner than climate change. You have a symposium coming up in New York about the dynamics of possible nuclear extinction. I thought that was all over with, the threat of nuclear war, is it?
My God. No, it's worse than ever. I mean, it's now a hot war. The Cold War's been converted to a hot war. What happened was when the Cold War ended, everyone thought, thank God, including myself, and I'll get rid of the weapons. Well, George Herbert Walker Bush got rid of a few of his weapons in Europe to help Gorbachev move the nuclear weapons from the various Kazakhstans, etc., to Moscow. But then we got Clinton. And Clinton had no spine or backbone, and he hadn't been to Vietnam, so he hadn't sort of asserted himself as a killer and a, you know, a hero in the eyes of many people. So therefore, he had no guts to take on the Pentagon, and he left all the weapons in place. Nothing's changed. He could, in fact, if it had some moral courage, drafted a treaty to abolish nuclear weapons, which almost happened over a weekend when Reagan and Gorbachev met in Reykjavik in Iceland in 1987. However, and he could have then flown in Air Force One over to see Yeltsin, who was a hardened alcoholic and totally compliant with America, and said to him, Boris, sign here, we're going to abolish nuclear weapons. Now, why do I say that? Because of the 16,000 300 or 400 nuclear weapons in the world, no one knows exactly how many, Russia and America own 93% of them. And therefore, the only threat to life on the planet actually are the weapons that Russia and America hold. A small nuclear war between India and Pakistan using only 100 nuclear weapons the size of Hiroshima would create what's called nuclear autumn. There would be so much dust and oil deposits and radioactive fallout shot up into the stratosphere, it would cause a very big fall in temperature, and over a billion people would starve because the crops would fail over a number of years, and that's only 100 weapons. Well, Russia and America, they have over 1,000 big hydrogen bombs on hair trigger alert, ready to be launched at the press of a button by either Putin or by Obama. And I don't know if you ever look at Obama, but always walking behind him is a man with a suitcase, and in the suitcase are the codes to start a nuclear war, and that's called the football. And now, because of the Ukraine, where the neocons in the State Department orchestrated that coup of Yanukovych and put in Poroshenko, who's just an American stooge and puppet, for the first time now, Russia and America are confronting each other militarily since the Cold War ended, and the goodwill between both has dissipated. And it's clear from these neocons in America that they want to take over the Ukraine, and they're provoking Putin. Now, Putin doesn't like to be provoked, number one. Number two, imagine if Russia came to Canada and said, well, we're taking over Canada now. How would America react? And number three, Putin has put his weapons, they say, on a higher than normal state of alert. And almost certainly if he has, America has too. So we're at a very tenuous situation in history. The media is not writing about it, particularly the American media. The New York Times, Washington Post are both promoting these terrible neocons who orchestrated the coup in the Ukraine and blaming Putin. It's not Putin at all. It's America who's done this. And to add insult to injury, when they agreed, Gorbachev and Reagan, to end the Cold War, it was agreed in 1989, I think, that America would not enlarge NATO up near the Russian borders. Well, they've done exactly the opposite. And that push was orchestrated by Lockheed Martin and a man called Augustine, who's the head of Lockheed Martin, because if a country, little country like Lithuania, wants to join NATO, they have to become very adeptly armed, and that was great for Lockheed Martin because they could sell them all the weapons, of course, destroying the economy of those little countries. And that's what's happened in the name of so-called, quote, democracy. So NATO has enlarged these countries or orchestrated these little countries to be part of NATO right up to the border of Russia. And the Ukraine is the last sort of standout. This is terribly serious. It violates the treaty that Reagan and Gorbachev agreed together and the governments agreed together, and it's all been underhand. I wrote about it in my book, The New Nuclear Danger, but no one seems to know about it. And in the 80s, everybody knew about the threat of nuclear war, and they were terribly, terribly concerned. And now this is all sort of undercover. People are practicing what we call psychic numbing. And the truth is, we're all walking towards the cliff of nuclear annihilation like lemmings.
You know, when I read through the list of topics for the symposium, I think I had the reaction that many of my listeners might experience, even on hearing this. At first, I was angry that we still have to deal with all this nuclear madness, and it is just madness. And then I wanted to really run away and think of something else, and I think that's a pretty common reaction, isn't it?
Yes, but you know, human beings have an adrenal gland sitting just above their kidneys, which, when they're threatened, pumps out adrenaline. So if you're chased by a bull, for instance, your blood pressure goes up, your blood sugar goes up, your brain is on a very high state of alert, and you can leap a 6-foot-high fence. But long-distance threat is hard for humans to imagine, but running away doesn't do any good. It's like if I tell a patient they have cancer, yes, they want to run away. And I have to help them through their stages of grief to face the reality of their disease and face the reality of the horrible treatment that they will have to try and cure their cancer. And so the stages of grief are shock and disbelief, which is what you experienced when you read about the symposium, followed by depression, quite profound depression, and that's normal. And then you sort of bargain with God. And then you get really angry. And it's the angry phase, which is appropriate, which turns the shock and disbelief and grief into action, where you would sell your house to be able to afford treatment at the Mayo Clinic, for instance, although in Canada, healthcare is free. But my point is that, you know, you need to go through and acknowledge that your brain and psyche needs to go through those phases. But in the end, you will then be impelled, if you really honestly face reality, to try and save the planet. That's the truth, if you love this planet.
But Helen Caldicott, isn't it stretching it a bit to say humans could go extinct due to a nuclear war? How could that happen?
Okay, so one of the very excellent speakers I have at the symposium is a man called Alan Robock, who is a professor of meteorology at Rutgers University. And he, with a guy called Cruzan, have done the pioneering work about what happens meteorologically if there's a nuclear war. It would only take 1,000 bombs dropping on 100 cities, but in fact there are 2,000 bombs ready to be launched And now the exchange, nuclear exchange, will only take about half an hour to an hour between Russia and America. And as the cities burn, and they're now full of toxic chemicals, oil refineries, rubber, plastics, timber, you name it, as they burn, a huge cloud of toxic black radioactive smoke will be injected into the stratosphere. It will remain there for over 10 years. It will block out the sun almost totally for 10 years, producing a tremendous lowering of temperatures and a short ice age during which most creatures on Earth, but including humans, will freeze to death in the dark. Furthermore, the ozone will be totally depleted. So if indeed you went out in the sun, if there was any sun, for 3 minutes you'd get third-degree sunburn and go blind. And so a nuclear war would create conditions which are antithetical to life, total life, I mean. Maybe the cockroaches and the algae may survive. And this has been known for some time. And the Pentagon tries to deny that nuclear winter would happen, but it's now very well established. And so we're talking about the end of really the creation in a certain sense.
My, my, my. Well, I also worry about the danger from these very old nuclear weapons and their delivery systems sitting in silos ready to go off. And I presume they have computer controls, and maybe we could even have a nuclear war by accident. Is that possible?
Oh, definitely. And that's one of the other topics that will be addressed at the symposium. In fact, what instigated me to do this symposium is I read an article in the Atlantic Monthly some months ago quoting Stephen Hawking and a physicist called Max Tegmark, and they work in artificial intelligence. And the computers are moving so rapidly now that within about 10 years, they will take over most functions that humans already do, like planting crops and harvesting them, making the food. The cars will be computer-driven with no human input, the like. And you can see that happening already. The computers will become so intelligent and autonomous that they will be able to reproduce themselves. And what Hawking and Tegmark and others, including Elon Musk, are worried about is that computers could possibly start a nuclear war by themselves. And I thought, good God, when I read that, I knew nothing about that. So one of the main speakers is Max Tegmark from MIT, and Stephen Hawking may well provide a few words of welcome and about his concerns at the beginning of the symposium. The point you make about the missile silos, well, they're degrading rapidly, and a woman from 60 Minutes went out there recently and found that the computers are controlled by floppy disks, and also often the telephones don't work in the missile silos. In each silo, there are two men armed with a pistol, one to shoot the other if one shows signs of deviant behaviour. There are locks 12 feet apart to turn a key, but they've worked out if you tie a string on one key, one man can turn both locks. In the past year or a year and a half, over 70 of these men have been fired because they've been cheating on their exams, they've been taking drugs, they fall asleep in their silos. I've met some of their girlfriends who told me that some of them take drugs before they go to work. It's very boring sitting before a panel waiting to blow up the world if you receive the order, and they would because that's the way they've been trained. Furthermore, several of their commanding officers have recently been fired for inappropriate behaviour and for cheating and doing all sorts of things. So I don't really know how we're still here. And if it's bad in America, you'd have to know it's probably worse in Russia. I mean, I used to read stories about Russian soldiers who were so addicted to alcohol, when they couldn't get it, they used to drink the antifreeze liquid in their tanks. So we're in the hands of totally, totally fallible human beings. And if you look at the history of the nuclear age, I don't really, as a physician, looking at a prognosis of a dying planet, understand how we are still here.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with one of the great activists, Dr. Helen Caldicott. And we could also talk about the cyber war that's going on right now. Government computers, even some in the Department of Defense, have been hacked. It's just a matter of time, maybe, before a terrorist group or even some teenager in a basement launches a nuclear missile. Do you think that's beyond possibility?
They wouldn't launch one. The system set up so they would all be launched. Yeah, that's true. I spoke, I think, recently at the University of Minnesota, and there was a tutor in, or professor of computers who taught his students. And I said, well, you know, students, could they hack into the early warning systems? And he said, yes. And I said, well, why hasn't it happened? He said, well, I haven't quite worked out how to do it yet. There are over 1,000 instances per day of people hacking in to Pentagon computer systems, verified instances of hacking. I don't know how we're still here. And you could imagine a kid aged 16, a boy, with really very little frontal lobe development yet, thinking it might be really a hoot to hack into the computers, Russian or American, and start a nuclear war.
Well, let's talk more about the upcoming symposium. For the early listeners here, please tell us where and when it will be held and whether those who cannot attend will still be able to hear your list of speakers.
Okay, so it's going to be held at the New York Academy of Medicine on February the 28th and March the 1st. That's a weekend. If you go to my website, HelenCaldicottFoundation.org, you can download the list of speakers, who are absolutely fascinating. I've got anthropologists talking about, you know, the psychology of the weapons makers and designers, and I've got people talking about the politics of the situation, and Noam Chomsky talking about the current Ukrainian situation and the like, and the governmental situation in America. Incidentally, Canada's part of NORAD, North American Air Command, so you're an integral part of this whole planning for extinction of life on Earth. And if you go to HelenCaldicottFoundation.org, you can register to attend. It's only $60, I think, a day, or $60 for the whole 2 days with a free lunch. It would be well worth any of you, if you can have the time, to attend. It will be live streamed, so you can hear it.
Great. And you mentioned you've got two speakers who specialized in studying the culture of designing nuclear weapons at Lawrence Livermore Lab and Los Alamos. What is that insider group like, do you think?
Well, it's very interesting. Robert Scheer, who's a journalist, a very famous journalist, who wrote With Enough Shovels about how the Federal Emergency Management Agency was going to tell us how to survive a nuclear war. And the story was, if you have enough shovels to go around, we'll all make it, because as the missiles are heading towards America in their half-hour transit, that you get out your trusty shovel and you dig a hole 6 feet long and 3 feet wide and get in the hole and put two doors on top and 2 feet of dirt on top of the doors. And they said it's the dirt that does it that would save your life. So he wrote a book about that. But he also wrote another book called Star Warriors, and he investigated the people at Lawrence Livermore Labs who designed the weapons, and many of them are young men, you know, in their 20s and early 30s, who are clearly Aspergers, who have no relationships at all except with their computer screen, who are brilliant, who chew chewing gummy all day, eat ice cream and drink Coke, have no girlfriends, and they're really pathological, but really good for computers and designing nuclear weapons. Same would hold true in Los Alamos Labs. So we're in the hands of very deviant people, including also the politicians, if I may add, who many of them are sociopaths with no moral conscience. And so it's very important, as in medicine, to understand the etiology or the genesis of disease. And the disease inflicting our planet at the moment is the nuclear disease. And so it's very important to look at the people behind this disease and look at their own diseases and decide they must be removed from what they're doing on an urgency basis.
And you've written a book about the arms race in outer space, and I see you have another former Radio EcoShock guest, Bruce Gagnon, coming to speak about that. Are there nuclear weapons in space, or why should we be concerned about what's happening way above our heads?
But the missile defense system operates through space, all orchestrated by computers in the satellites and computers on Earth. And so the satellites in space pick up the glow of the sun on the weapons, and then they can direct the anti-missile on to the weapon travelling through space. The trouble is that most of the missiles are MIRVed. MIRVing means each missile has multiple independent re-entry vehicles. A re-entry vehicle is a hydrogen bomb. America's MIRVed hers. I've got the Minuteman missiles have 3 hydrogen bombs, but some of the Russian missiles have 10. And also you can confuse the computers and satellites by putting bits of aluminium foil in with the bombs, and so the foil reflects the light of the sun too, and it's very easy to confuse the anti-missile system, but that's what space is being used for. But more than that, space is being used to orchestrate a nuclear war and determine the targets and so that the bombs land accurately on target. And much of it's orchestrated through an American base in the centre of Australia called Pine Gap, which is set up to orchestrate a nuclear war. And then the message gets through to Pine Gap, and then they radio back to, I think, the Strategic Air Command in Omaha, Nebraska. They think about it, then they radio through to the White House, and in the end, Obama has only 3 minutes to decide whether or not to press the button, and the same holds true for Putin.
You know, Helen, people under the age of 25 would not remember the great nuclear standoff between the old Soviet Union and the NATO nuclear countries. Many have probably never been to a march against nuclear weapons. How can we tell those younger people that the horror continues and maybe spark up some activism in the colleges and around the world?
Well, you know, it was President Jefferson who said an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. And if people and students are totally uninformed about this, of course they'll walk like lemmings towards a cliff of annihilation. Therefore, education is absolutely key. And one of the reasons I organized this symposium was hoping to get the major media to cover it. Most people now, although the young ones don't, but most people still watch television. And the only way to teach the majority of people is through the media. In fact, the media is determining the fate of the Earth, absolutely. And so I am determined to get the major media to the symposium to start covering this issue in a very urgent fashion. Wish me luck as you wave me goodbye, you know. I'm doing the best I can, but it's imperative that every college student, every high school student, every university student now learns these facts, and that we need a revolution. We had a revolution in the 80s where, when I first went to America in the 70s, almost everyone said to me, it's better to be dead than red. And I thought, these people must be mad. And so I orchestrated Physicians for Social Responsibility, and we taught people that nuclear was bad for their health and would create the final medical epidemic of the human race. And over a 5-year period, 80% of Americans rose up and said, we won't have these nuclear weapons anymore. It was called the Freeze Movement. And the same happened in Canada. But in fact, the movement occurred all over the world. I started physicians groups in most countries of the world, including Canada. And that was a revolution. I would say the second American revolution, which was quiet, peaceful, sagacious, Gandhian. And now we need the third revolution, and it should happen in Canada and America and all across the world if we want to survive.
You know, we've battled this dark theology of nuclear weapons for most of our adult lives. They are still with us. Is there some hope? Have there been some wins?
Well, the wins were in the 80s where, you know, we handed Clinton on a silver platter the ability to abolish nuclear weapons when the majority of Americans supported that concept. And then that opportunity was lost. And so it was an incredible win, which was lost. And if there's a nuclear war, it's Clinton's legacy, I have to tell you. But also the people in the Pentagon, the people who run the Pentagon and not the officers in general, they are Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing, Northrop Grumman. So you're an integral part of the extremely mad nuclear madness. And so you've got to learn what your government is up to and learn what these corporations are up to within your own country and close them down, close them down. They're creating the global gas oven. That's what they're doing, the global gas oven.
It's perhaps a little bit stronger still in Europe, where we still have quite a few listeners as well, and I have a bit of optimism. You know, Helen, I'd really like to hear your views on a couple of other current problems. Can you stay with us a little longer?
Yes, just a little, yes.
Okay. Well, I wanted to ask you about the recent nuclear deal announced by Obama to provide nuclear technology to India. I found it very disturbing. What do you think about that deal?
Oh, it's absolutely crazy. And India, in fact, made its first bomb from one of your CANDU reactors, Canadian reactors. You gave them a reactor and the uranium, or maybe sold it. It doesn't matter. And so any country that has a nuclear power plant makes plutonium, which makes bombs. So what it's doing is increasing the proliferation of nuclear weapons around the world in other countries. So it's terribly dangerous, and Obama was helped to be elected by Exelon, which owns nuclear power plants all around Chicago, and that's where he comes from. And so he represents the nuclear power companies, so he's just really a lobbyist, really. It's very, very disturbing. I agree with you, Alex.
One last thing. At the end of January, a new video was posted on YouTube about the real health impact at the triple meltdown in Fukushima, Japan. And a resident there, Chieko Shina, said the Japanese government and health authorities are trying to hide a huge spike in thyroid cancer in children living near the accident site. And I presume you wouldn't be surprised about that at all.
Well, I've been following that very closely, and I held a conference on Fukushima last year at the New York Academy of Medicine. And if you want to read the proceedings from that symposium, it's published in a book called Crisis Without End, Crisis Without End by the New Press. Yes, in the Fukushima prefecture, now about 104 children have developed thyroid cancer. The normal incidence in such a population is 1 in 1 million or 2 in 1 million. Yes, this is the tip of the iceberg. It indicates that there'll be many, many other cancers in various organs throughout this generation. More radiation was released from Fukushima than at Chernobyl. And the Japanese government is covering it up. The doctors have been told not to tell their patients that symptoms could be related to radiation. The government has passed a law so that any journalist who writes about Fukushima could be jailed for 10 years. Japan is a big producer of parts for nuclear reactors and exports them to Turkey and all over the world, so they want to keep going. It's the most audacious, horrific cover-up in the history of medicine, because this is a medical issue. Over 1 million people have already died as a result of Chernobyl, and they will continue to die because the land in Europe will remain radioactive for hundreds of years. Nuclear accidents never end, and so you transfer that data to the Fukushima situation, and yes, we may expect up to 1 million people to die during this generation and more in the future to come. Much of the food in Japan is radioactive, particularly in the Fukushima prefecture. I saw a photograph yesterday of English politicians eating Fukushima food to prove it's safe. Well, they won't get their cancers for maybe 10 or 20 years. And when they do, the cancer won't identify its origin, saying, I was made by some cesium you ate in some food that was generated in Fukushima 20 years ago. And Tokyo, parts of Tokyo are extremely radioactive, and people are still living in Tokyo. I've read of a physician who worked there, and he said, if I could, I would evacuate all the children in Tokyo. Children are very, very sensitive to radiation. So things are grim. They're very grim.
Yes, everything I've seen indicates that Tokyo got a bath of radioactivity and then got some more when the rain washed the river water in, and we could talk for that for a long time. I'm so grateful that you have joined us today. It's really important. We've been speaking with Helen Caldicott. She is the greatest nuclear activist seen so far on this planet. She founded numerous groups which still run today. And from my reading list of Helen's 7 books, I think you should at least read Crisis Without End, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Catastrophe, just published in October 2014. And I also recommend War in Heaven, another of her books written with Craig Eisendrath. And of course, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer to Global Warming or Anything Else. That's just an absolute classic. You must read it. You can find out more about the symposium, The Dynamics of Possible Nuclear Extinction, held February 28th to March 1st at the New York Academy of Medicine at the website HelenCaldicottFoundation.org, and stay tuned to everything Caldicott at HelenCaldicott.com. I'll be putting all those links in my own blog, published Wednesday at Ecoshock.info. Helen Caldicott, thank you so much for speaking with us and for never giving up.
Thank you very much, Alex, for this interview.
Radio EcoShock will be right back with David Bowyer. Please stay tuned.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
The news slaps us in the face. 1% of humans will control more than half the wealth of the world. This is the result of what author David Bowyer calls the market state. It's that tight marriage of billionaires, megacorporations, and our former democratic institutions. A host of problems boil out of this paradigm of power, including climate change. We've been told there is no alternative. David Bowyer says there is. And it's an idea we've been taught almost to hate, the commons. His most recent book is Think Like a Commoner, A Short Introduction to the Life of the Commons, whatever that is. It's one of those twisty ideas, the deeper you look, the deeper it gets. David has been at this for 15 years as an independent scholar, blogger, and writer. David Bowyer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's great to be here.
Well, I often like to define a few terms, David, and lay out what we're going to talk about, but this time I think because of the topic, that's a bad idea. Can we start instead with a couple of examples of things that work like a commons?
Well, the commons can be broadly understood as everything that we share and own together, and it can be as broad as the atmosphere and the oceans, public lands, public research that the government does, to things that are really socially driven, such as online communities or open source software or Wikipedia. There's all sorts of urban commons where people get together to manage public spaces or community gardens. So it has to be understood as not just a thing or resource, but as a social paradigm, a social system for managing collective resources.
Okay, so could you give me just one concrete example?
I gave you several there, like Wikipedia and open source software are maybe for the digital crowd very familiar ones, but other ones would be national parks or federal research for drug research, which is then handed over virtually for free to the drug industry. And then there's things like the standards or protocols that allow the internet to function. So those protocols are kind of a shared way of managing all this digital traffic. You could say that the internet is a great hosting infrastructure for creating commons. So it's really, the commons is kind of a way of looking at and perceiving different types of resources in a way that's different from the standard economic market approach to them.
And yet, there is a political party in the United States and in many countries dedicated to privatizing everything, including prisons, hospitals, and schools. Talk to us about the forces working against the commons.
Well, that's just it. You can't talk about the commons without talking about the so-called enclosure of the commons. An enclosure is a process of privatizing and commoditizing these shared resources. In other words, turning them into input for the market, so that the gains from the market transactions can be privatized. And that's really, I think, the great unacknowledged scandal of our time, that vast quantities of our shared resources are being enclosed. And, this goes to the human genome, one-fifth of which is now privately owned through patents, to all sorts of intellectual property where people claim ownership of words and phrases, to the extension of copyright. So enclosure is this really quite pervasive phenomena in much of global capitalism to take over these free resources and put them to purpose for private market gain.
Well, and another problem we have is our indoctrination. Most of us learn two things in school. The communes all failed and communism is horrible. David, do you think the multiple failures of the Soviet Union set back communalism for a generation or more?
Well, I think in the United States, people are really, it's taboo to talk about collective things because the great bugaboo has been communism for so long. But it's important to understand that communism was about the government collectively organizing these things, whereas the commons is, in its the standard state, self-organized, voluntary organizing of these things. Sometimes the resources are so large the government has to get involved. But let's just say that the commons is quite distinct from communism.
So then we have the meme that the commons is a tragedy. Where did that come from?
Well, there was a famous 1968 essay by this biologist named Garrett Hardin, who wrote an essay called The Tragedy of the Commons. And basically, it was kind of this parable that he said, imagine you have a pasture and everybody can put as many cattle as they want on that pasture as they want. What will happen to it? It will be overexploited and ruined. This is the so-called tragedy of the commons. He claimed that none of the people would have a rational individual reason for withholding. But this is just not empirical in the sense of, yes, people do overuse shared resources, but it's also true that people in real-life circumstances tend to talk to each other and negotiate a set of rules for preventing the overexploitation of a shared resource. And this is, in fact, what Eleanor Ostrom, a woman who won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2009, discovered, that all sorts of people from forest and fisheries and farmland and irrigation water are perfectly capable of collectively negotiating rules for managing those shared resources so they don't get overexploited and depleted. So the tragedy of the commons is, in a sense, a smear against the idea of group governance of a resource. And it's also been quite useful to conservatives and free market ideologues who like to say that the only solution is private property and markets, and that collective management of a resource will always fail, which is just not true.
Now, in my early life, I was part of the Back to the Land movement. In the 1960s and 70s, I gobbled up the book Heavens on Earth, Utopian Communities in America, 1680 to 1880 by Mark Holloway. It's still a classic worth a read. And it was a revelation to me that America has a history of communes. What happened to them?
Well, I'm not an expert on communes, and I'm sure that's a very complex story. But I also think that there probably was all sorts of reasons that they couldn't be financially self-sustaining, and they put too much effort on certain individual members. And there are a lot of commons that continue to work, I should add. But I think that the challenge for most commons, speaking generally, is how you manage collective action problems, meaning how do you manage free riders or cheaters or people who overexploit. And any successful commons develops rules and institutional systems for dealing with that. And it's quite possible that the communes of the 60s and 70s didn't do that, because that's the standard way for commons to fail, to not have the systems to prevent the people from unfairly taking advantage of the group.
All right. Now, there is more communal idealism, David, outside the United States, for example, in Europe. And then you say up to 2 billion people depend on some form of the commons to survive. Just briefly tell us about them.
Well, I think that because we see the so-called global South through the prism of standard economics, we tend not to see that all sorts of traditional communities, indigenous peoples, and many others, as villages, as communities, as groups of farmers, as groups of fishermen, manage those resources as commons. And these, I might add, that these commoners are doing it for their everyday subsistence and not necessarily for the market. So right there, it goes under the radar screen of most standard economics who, after all, are looking for market transactions as a sign of something significant going on. Whereas any commons, there's not usually market transactions, and so it's not even seen by economics, or it's regarded as marginal or not significant. But as I say, there's an estimated 2 billion people who depend in their everyday lives for water, forest products, fisheries, farmland, and the like for their everyday needs.
You know, I'm getting the idea that I'm really limited by my own idea. I started out thinking about communes, you know, the Amish, the Hutterites, the Mormons, perhaps native reserves. But you're talking about something much bigger than that. And not, it's not necessarily about just going to a piece of land and living separately from everybody else. It's doing something together.
Well, precisely. And I think that the truth is that there are commons all around us that we don't necessarily recognize as such. Or, you know, for example, the countless numbers of online communities that we participate in as giving members and as people who receive benefits from them. That's the commons. And one purpose of talking about the commons is to start to recognize that there's an entire class of phenomena of important economic activity and social enjoyment that occurs through commons, and therefore we need to be able to protect those commons from being converted into just market resources. So that's part of what the commons is all about, is recognizing the valuable things that occur through this collective management and how socially satisfying it can be.
Well, in a way, this radio program is part of the commons because we're going out over nonprofit radio stations, community-owned radio stations. So there's an example where the airwaves have kind of been grabbed back by the people and used for our own purposes.
Absolutely. The only refinement I would put on that is that in a classic commons, there's generally a bottom-up, self-organizing dynamic at work in which people make the rules by which they're going to be governed, as opposed to top-down hierarchies dictating that even for nonprofit purposes. So the commons, in more classic terms, is about self-governance and democracy in ways that we determine ourselves. And so in some ways it's taking the focus of democracy from just electoral politics in government and bringing it down to self-provisioning in all sorts of ways. And, you know, this is about really reclaiming a certain sense of control and sovereignty from the dependence that the market likes to get us roped into. So it's a very broad territory to talk about, far more than just communal activity.
Well, David Bollier, didn't humans evolve as a communal species? Is that kind of hardwired into us?
Well, you know, if you talk to evolutionary scientists, they say that this is really kind of the default mode of human beings organizing themselves, and that the whole idea of the self-made man as an individual and of Homo economicus that economists talk about, the utility-maximizing selfish individual, these are historical aberrations that have only existed in the past couple hundred years, but that historically the human race has found all sorts of collaborative means to advance its welfare in groups, and that the commons is really more the default than the market.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, David Bollier. We're talking about an alternative to super-individualism and to capitalism. David's new book is Think Like a Commoner, A Short Introduction to the Life of the Commons. I have so many questions. Do people form a commons when they're poor but leave when they get more money? And why don't millions of poor Americans form a commons when hundreds of millions of very poor people in developing countries do?
Well, you raise a great number of questions. But in fact, right now in Greece, which is in the vanguard of austerity politics, they've been at the forefront of developing a lot of these collective solutions that are both commons-based, and they're also using a lot of so-called peer production techniques, digital online communities, to meet survival needs. I think in American history, we have all sorts of these examples from the progressive movement and cooperatives, for example, but many of these have been papered over or forgotten, or one might say deliberately suppressed by the whole economics discipline, which really I think is intellectually, if not ideologically, opposed to the very idea of certain collective solutions. So there are many, many examples out there, both emerging that are being created, as well as ones from history.
And you've said the commons is both a cause and a possible solution for climate change. Could you elaborate on that, David?
Well, I don't believe that any top-down solution that is forced on people is going to work very well because it won't have their consent or participation, let alone the innovation they could bring to it. And therefore, it won't reach to the levels and the changes of lifestyle and motivation that we need to reach. However, if we start to delegate authority and responsibility as well as benefit downward to people into viable commons for managing certain natural resources, or start to have infrastructure managed for collective benefit
rather than for the corporate owner of important infrastructure, whether it's highways or pipeline or something, or the atmosphere, which is a kind of infrastructure, then we can start to reorient the governance of it. Right now, the governance is managed by the nation state and international bodies, both of which are basically captive to global capitalism and its imperatives. So starting to introduce the commons as a governance framework for all sorts of natural resources is a way to start to change the logic in the way we think about how we our relationship to the resources. So this is obviously is a longer term proposition in a time when we don't have much time. On the other hand, I don't see the current logic yielding the results we need either, and we do need to get out of that rut and start to admit that there's a certain insanity in thinking the old approaches are going to work.
You know, it may sound strange, but researching the commons brought up some strong feelings in me, things I thought I was over. I mean, the fact that the Koch brothers became multi-billionaires with free pollution of our atmosphere, or Tokyo Electric Power Company thinks it's okay to dump tons of radioactivity into our Pacific Ocean, it makes me a little bitter and angry. Do you think the idea of the commons can become emotional for people?
Well, that's the point. People, unlike in a market where you have an impersonal relationship with what's going on, it's just business, impersonal. The commons is about having personal, emotional relationships with the resources that matter to you. And therefore, you protect them more, you defend them more. So it's partly about reintegrating ourselves, for example, with the earth, with that special body of water, with that special mountain range that we hike in. And once we start to have those relationships, I think we start to relate to them in a different way and don't say, oh, well, the EPA will take care of that. No, it's something that we need to start to step up and take care of and find the governance mechanisms to be meaningfully involved. So partly this is about a reorientation of our vision. It's partly also about inventing some new ways of governing and managing these resources than the nation state currently allows.
Let's talk about some of the big voices in the commons movement. Please tell us more about the late Professor Eleanor Ostrom from Indiana University. What did she contribute?
Eleanor Ostrom spent 30 or 40 years studying all sorts of natural resource commons, mostly in rural and developing countries. But she was swimming upstream against the economic orthodoxy of her time, because she actually believed that people could self-organize the management of shared resources at a time when economics said that's impossible. Moreover, she was a woman working in a very sexist profession. But in 2009, she became the first woman to win the Nobel Prize in economics for her lifetime of research in this area. And there are now hundreds of scholars around the world who explicitly study commons as commons and why they work and why they don't work on those occasions when they don't. So she was kind of an intellectual vanguard for showing that, contrary to conventional economics, this stuff can work. I might add, she won the Nobel Prize the year after the 2008 financial crisis, at a time when the Nobel Prize Committee, I suspect, was trying to find alternatives to the standard way of doing things, which is, of course, the quest we're still involved in, is finding the successor to that standard economic approach.
Absolutely. Well, who are a couple of other names that people could look up to find out more about this, other than yourself, of course?
Well, I must say that Europe is far more advanced than those of us in the United States who are interested in the commons, because Italy is extremely advanced in all sorts of experimentation and thinking. I know there's a Belgian fellow who's a colleague of mine, Michel Ballens, who runs something called the Peer-to-Peer Foundation. And he is really quite a pioneer and leading thinker in terms of peer production and digital commons. You know, all sorts of things from not just open source software and wikis, but there's now open source design and production of physical things, from cars to furniture and beyond. I have another colleague in Europe, a woman named Silke Helfrich, a German, and Germany is also quite advanced in thinking about the commons, especially in conjunction with the Green Party and the Heinrich Böll Foundation. Spain, Greece, Italy or other areas where there's a lot going on. If you go to my website, bollier.org, B-O-L-L-I-E-R.org, I have a whole blog role which lists the more significant organizations and websites that are involved in this area.
Yeah, your blog goes back to 2004. That's ancient history in the blog world.
Well, it takes a while to develop this alternative perspective, and I've been traveling around amassing this perspective. And I have to say, it's a rather large network that I don't think has been fully acknowledged or recognized by the mainstream, but there's a lot of really interesting experimentation and innovation going on.
All right, let's look at a couple of your books. What can folks expect to find in the 2012 work, The Wealth of the Commons?
Well, this was an attempt by my German colleague Silke Helfrich and I to pull together more than 70 essays by a group of international activists, academics, and project leaders to show just the breadth of activity going on in this area. Many of the essays focus on enclosures of the commons where, for example, mega projects are damming up rivers in Latin America or mining is destroying the environment there. Many of the other essays are focusing on all sorts of creative innovations, such as the city of Linz, Austria, has declared itself an open information commons and has created, for example, free Wi-Fi hotspots and email for all citizens, and all government information is made available under Creative Commons licenses, meaning it can't be privatized, and all sorts of other efforts to try to make information as free and circulating as possible. So that book describes a full range of eclectic, interesting commons projects going on.
You're starting to give me some hope, and I hate it when that happens. So you also co-authored Green Governance, Ecological Survival, Human Rights, and the Law of the Commons with Professor Burns Weston. The topic's a bit too big for a short radio interview, but we could dig into at least the idea of vernacular law. What is that, and how could that apply to some of the things our listeners might be dreaming of doing?
Well, once again, we think that there's all sorts of we've seen the failures of international law and federal law in dealing with many of these problems. We haven't begun to recognize that there's this kind of bottom-up street law of sensibility that needs to be honored and recognized, because I think many of these natural resource commons, for example, are far more ecologically respectful and sustainable than anything the market throws at it. So this kind of socially based law needs to be recognized as a important, powerful force in its own right. And that's what we tried to do in our book, Green Governance, is to show how law, formal law, needs to take greater cognizance of the importance of what we call vernacular law, which is this bottom-up sense of, what shall I say, rules and protocols among people in a commons, how they want to manage the resource. So it's a different way of thinking about how we can manage resources beyond simply bureaucracies and courts, which is not to say it's an either-or proposition. It's more a matter of expanding the scope of what law consists of.
And so your latest book, just out really, is Think Like a Commoner, A Short Introduction to the Life of the Commons. What approach do you take there?
Well, this is an attempt to really speak to my mother, to my friends, in a more accessible voice than some of the other things that have been written about the commons, and to explain why this is of importance to ordinary people and citizens in thinking about how we move forward at a time when our political system is in gridlock and dysfunctional, and how the market and the state are essentially in a conspiracy to take over and privatize lots of our shared wealth. So learning how to think like a commoner helps us begin to address that dynamic of what I call the market state duopoly.
Well, given how embedded most of us are in this market state, I think efforts to build something else are going to be experimental. We don't have a fixed roadmap for where this can go, do we?
No, but that's, of course, precisely the only way that we can get out of our rut that we're in. If we look to the conventional political parties or the political systems, they're not going to give us the kind of innovation we need. I mean, we saw a glimmer of that with Occupy, which, of course, had trouble institutionalizing and advancing its vision in a more continuous way. I think the commons is a way for us to conceptualize it. It gives us a whole body of historical precedents to draw upon, a whole body of political precedents to guide us in how we can engage. And as I say, globally, there's many, many projects that are starting to federate and cooperate with each other, especially in Europe and the global south, which are a new source of solidarity. And I think for Americans who are a bit behind the curve on this, a source of inspiration as well.
Listeners, I think David Bollier's website is an excellent place to start if you want to know more. He's got some short introductions there, some links to videos, podcasts, free podcasts, blog articles, the works. You can find that at bollier.org, as he says, bollier.org. And I'll be putting a bunch of links that I hope will help you in my own weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.info. Let's find out what we have in common and build on that. David, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. That's our show for this week. Next week, we talk about the previous great mass extinctions with the British expert scientist Dr. Paul Wignall, and the possibility of our electric grid going down, as just happened when Pakistan went dark at the end of January. Stay tuned to Radio EcoShock for that. Find links for today's program and my weekly Radio EcoShock blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. You can download any or all of our past programs as free MP3 files from the website at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith, saying thank you for listening and thank you for caring about your world.
Love will live in troubled times. Hearts can give when storms come. A human wave can come together. Minds arise as surely as the seas. Divine forms in the minds of many. We believe in the heat. Days flow by to our times of trials. Minds in motion with the beat.
Make a future we can trust.